Wow. So I think we need to start out by being totally transparent and I'm just being like technologically vulnerable to our listeners and say that this is the third time we're trying to record this conversation. How are you doing, Ross?
I'm doing good. I'm good.
You're okay with starting over three times?
Oh, yeah, it's practice. What the heck?
Right. So As I told you before, because we had this intro three times now, I'm really curious and I'm really inspired by your work, because these are complex and, I mean, gritty human subjects, right?
Right.
Narcissism, self-love, codependency, and I think it would be valuable to our listeners to understand you as a human being, and where your passion and your devotion comes from. How come you focus so much on narcissism?
Yeah, it's interesting because I accidentally became an expert on narcissism. It never was my intention. My book, and there's two versions of it. The latest one is called The Human Magnet Syndrome, The Codependency Cure. It first was written in 2013. And it's the first of its kind where it explains why codependents always habitually, unconsciously, reflexively fall in love with narcissists. It was my attempt to work in my own head and mind why I kept falling in love with these people that would seem so beautiful in the beginning, but so hurtful, that why the soulmate would end up being the cellmate.
Right.
And so in my own attempts, in my own personal psychotherapy, my therapist helped me figure out what was wrong with my picker. I just kept picking the wrong one. And then because of so much shame that I had, because I was a therapist, and yet I wasn't able to get this whole relationship thing right, I dug deep into my heart, my mind, and to figure out what the heck is going on. And I found out that this attraction that I have to the cellmate that once was a soulmate was because of something about me. And that was the impetus or the inspiration to write my book. And in the book, I explained to understand the human magnet syndrome, why we keep falling in love with this same person but with a different face. We have to understand not only our codependency, what is it about us that predisposes us to fall in love with someone who's harmful that we think is loving, we also have to understand the person we fall in love with. So the book explains in detail narcissism and explains in detail codependency and the relationship and attraction dynamic. So then I started, when the first book came out, I started putting videos on YouTube. And it just seemed that my videos on narcissism got a lot more views than the videos on codependency. So now I have a YouTube channel that has 125 videos and it's been viewed nearly 16 million times, by 160,000 subscribers. And about a third of the content is on narcissism. So I accept that and I'm proud of it, that I'm an expert on narcissists. But my focus is not on helping narcissists. My focus is helping people who have been in relationships by abusive, controlling, harmful narcissists because of their own attraction pattern. So yes, I accept it and I'm proud that I know a lot about narcissists, but it's not because I work with them. It's because I know about them.
And what's the reason that you know about them? I mean, personally, what's the root to your codependency and your attraction to narcissists?
Yeah, well, according to my book, The Human Magnet Syndrome, is that people fall in love because of unconscious forces. This whole chemistry thing, when you meet someone and, one person can be beautiful and there's no chemistry and another person can be beautiful and there's tons of chemistry. The forces that create attraction or chemistry are unconscious and they come from our ideas, our instincts on relationship. And those are formed in our childhood. If you were raised by a pathological narcissist, all codependents have a narcissistic parent. And according to the Human Magnet Syndrome, then the other one is obviously a codependent, because they, like a dancing partnership, the narcissist and the codependent being opposite. The controller, the taker, needs the passive giver who relinquishes their power, and that dance ties them together. But if you were raised by a pathological narcissist, the codependent was a child, the adult codependent was once the child that figured out a way to make the narcissist love them, like them, and respect them. They molded their personality into the type of person that the narcissist needed, or at least wouldn't get mad. So every codependent has a childhood history of being the trophy child, the good child, the one in which the narcissist adored. So by figuring out how to mold your personality into the trophy, into the personal extension of a narcissistic parent, you learn that love, and this is at, this is during our formative stage, this is at a time where a child is just learning about life and relationships. They learn that love and self-worth requires sacrifice, requires them to mold themselves into the person the narcissist needs them to be. So during that childhood attachment phase, they create this relationship template that I am only a human. I am only as good as what I do for others, or someone once called a human doing instead of a human being.
Right.
And that relationship template morphs into what will become an adult who feels safe and familiar with people who are narcissistic. And that's the basis of the Human Magnet Syndrome.
And how, just to help me understand it even deeper, how would you define a narcissist?
So a narcissist, in my book, I'm very specific, because there's thousands of people on YouTube that profess to be experts on this stuff. At the core of who I am is I'm a psychotherapist. I've been in the mental health field for over 32 years. So everything I talk about is based in clinical psychology and mental health science and theory. So when I call them pathological narcissists. It includes three personality disorders. These are mental health diagnoses. One is a narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, or antisocial personality disorder, which is someone who's a sociopath or a psychopath. Mm. And these three all have a narcissistic core. And codependents are attracted to one of these three type of narcissists. But they're very different, but they all have this narcissistic core.
And the narcissistic core is what?
That was the question. Thank you. So is selfishness, entitlement, manipulation, low levels or lack of empathy, vanity, being controlling, needing to be the center of conversations, wanting to control others. They make everything about themselves. They are reflexively geared in relationships to look at themselves as the most important person while demeaning others around them. And there's many variations on a theme. And in my YouTube videos, I've subcategorized narcissists in at least 7 or 8 different categories.
And what would you say is the main reason for someone acting like that or being a narcissist? I mean, what's the root of that?
So if we look at when I talked about the attachment trauma, when I explain why does someone become codependent, and I say during the attachment phase, the critical time between age 0 to around 7, the way the child is cared for sets up their ideas about themselves and relationships. So the child, as I explained a few minutes ago, who was able to mold themselves into their parents' trophy child, made them feel good, but they had sacrifice. The child who could not mold themselves, who could not figure out a way to make the narcissistic parent happy, they were subject to narcissistic injuries. They were subject to deprivation, abuse, neglect, abandonment. Because a narcissist can only be in a relationship with someone that makes them feel good. So if you were the bad child, and I quote that, the bad seed, the narcissistic parent will resent that child. Narcissists do not like people that don't make them happy. So that child's attachment experience is fundamentally different from the child who's going to be codependent. That it's going to be very, very neglectful and abusive, lonely. And that early trauma of a child getting nothing, because the child who's going to eventually be codependent got something, that is the basis of the severe trauma that crystallizes in the disorders that I explained about, the three personality disorders. So narcissism comes from severe attachment trauma at the hands of the narcissistic parent. And I have to say, the parent who is codependent could not protect them. Because that's why it's a personality disorder. It's so severe, they don't know they have the problem. They have no insight into it. It's all cordoned off and disassociated from their mind because of their childhood trauma is so bad.
So if I'm understanding you right, narcissistic parent could raise either a narcissistic child or a codependent child.
Absolutely. And if you ever meet someone who fits the diagnostic profile of a codependent and you ask them, do you have siblings?
Oh, yeah.
The probability is very, very high that you are either on one side. In my book, I have a continuum. And it's a little bit complicated, and I'm not sure if we need to talk about it now, but that'll be up to you. But I have a continuum, and you're either going to be on one side or the other. So if you're a codependent, your siblings are more than likely going to either be codependent or narcissists. A narcissist needs at least one person in a family to make them feel good. Sometimes a narcissist has a couple children. So these families raise narcissists or codependents. Which is why, in my book, The Human Magnet Syndrome, the very first chapter of the book is I explain how this problem goes from generation to generation. And if you don't solve the problem in yourself, you're going to be raising, if you have children, the next generation of narcissists or codependents.
So is it solvable? Are you able to stop it?
Yeah. In my work that followed the Human Magnet Syndrome, I created what is called my codependency cure work, or otherwise known as my self-love recovery program. And I've created a comprehensive theoretical framework and a treatment program that addresses the causes of codependency, which is attachment trauma. If you think of a pyramid, at the very bottom of this pyramid is the trauma that I talked about. From this childhood trauma comes core shame, thinking you're fundamentally broken and not lovable. From that core shame comes pathological loneliness, is this deep existential emptiness, feeling that you're unlovable and that no one is going to love you, and it's this deep bone-aching feeling of loneliness. From that loneliness comes this addiction to somehow take that pain away, the loneliness pain, and I call that codependency or addiction. And from that addiction, that compulsion to be in a relationship to take the pain away, is what we call codependency or self-love deficit disorder, as I later called it. So the problem that people go to therapy for is our symptoms. And that's why no one has gotten better, is the therapists don't know why codependency is formed. And if you don't know what is formed, you just work on symptoms. It's like if you have a really bad infection, and you keep getting antibiotics, but there's something at the core in your body that's causing the infection. So it's absolutely treatable. And that's what my next book is going to be about, the codependency cure. I have videos on my website, the selfloverecovery.com, and my seminars, which I'm always producing, are all about this cure, this treatment for codependency.
I mean, the way you're describing codependency, and you said codependency and addiction, but it almost sounds like an addiction itself.
Okay, so codependency addiction. Okay, yeah. Using my pyramid model, and understand that codependency is, and I define this in my book, the Human Magnet Syndrome takes this very broad subject, that is misunderstood, mislabeled. I don't even like the word codependency, which is why I later would name it self-love deficit disorder, or SLDD. So what I did was I simplified the definition, because you can't solve a problem if the problem is so widely defined and everyone has a different opinion on it. So simply, codependency is when you are in a relationship and you give all or most of love, respect, and caring. You expect it to be mutual or reciprocated. It's not. You try to make it mutual. You cannot, and you stay in the relationship. That's it. If you can accept, and the world has embraced it because the book has sold 100,000 copies and it's in 8 languages, accept that simplistic explanation, then you could understand why codependency is so there's so many people that have it, and it takes the shame out of it. It talks about a relationship dynamic.
Right, and I'm also thinking a lot about when I hear you speak. I'm thinking about the like how to break that cycle, because you talk about self-love, right?
Right.
And in my opinion, talking about self-love is not that simple, because there's a stigma. There's a stigma around these subjects. Like, you should be able to love yourself. You should be able to navigate these emotions. And there's an air of shame around it as well. Like,
you know, it's interesting, because it depends on your culture and you know where you're brought up and even your communities, your family, your country, is. In the United States, there's less of a stigma about self-love. But because over half of the people that I treat, because most of my work is done through video, I have an international practice, I understand that it's different depending on people's ethnicity, communities, culture, countries. But I think it's the definition of self-love, you know, because self-love can mean so many different things to other people. But when I explain self-love, it's just taking care of yourself, respecting yourself, allowing yourself to not be hurt. The people who hear that don't stigmatize that. It's not something you can laugh at. It doesn't sound like something that would be embarrassing. And that's why I changed the name from codependency to self-love deficit disorder, because if there is a stigma on the name of your problem, then you are more embarrassed and less likely to get help, because codependency has a sound. Actually, the word itself doesn't mean anything. It was invented 30 years ago, and it means something completely different from what it meant then. But at every one of my clients, the people that follow me on my social networking platforms, my website, my YouTube channel, they embrace the term self-love deficit disorder, because my goal is only to reach these codependents, these SLDs, people who are self-love deficient. I'm not worried about anyone else. My focus is just in this population, and they embrace it. They all say, that's right. That is my problem. I don't love myself. It is intuitive for them. So the treatment is to solve that, so that you go from self-love deficient to self-love abundant. And that's the cure, is to solve the fundamental problems, the trauma, the shame, the loneliness, the addiction. And it changes what I call the emotional DNA. And when people can love themselves, there's no embarrassment or stigma on that. So it's actually people, that the people are embracing this idea quite more easily than I once thought.
I think those people are not necessarily representative of what I'm talking about, because the people embracing the idea are the ones embracing the idea.
Right.
So I'm talking about the ones who are not, but are still having the problem.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. You're right.
I'm probably talking from my own experience, because I found it really difficult to start talking about the about the sense of loneliness and disattachment, and And I had a lot of issues of isolation when I first started exploring these dark rooms myself. Mm-hmm. And I felt that like the hardest part was to connect with other people and tell them about my lack of self-love or my abundance of self-hate.
and I call that core shame.
Yeah.
And it's private. Anyone that has core shame, they keep it private.
Yeah.
But if I'm not here to diagnose you, but if you were an SLD, and you were in a safe place where you can, and you just wanted to stop it, because the people I work with, remember, I'm a psychotherapist, who has become an educator, who's come, but people come to see me and they just want to stop the pain of falling in love with narcissists. It's like that pain of, you know, that, you know, whether they're gaslit, brainwashed, abused, neglected, and they come to me, and what happens for the first time is they're told both that they're a victim and they are responsible. And once they understand that not only it was their choices, because of their fear of being lonely and their beliefs of having these shame-based beliefs about themselves that made them vulnerable to these relationships with narcissists, they finally have the explanation and they finally have an opportunity to talk about the shame. Because everyone that's an SLD or codependent, they carry this core shame, this loneliness, and because there's such a stigma to it, they never talk about it. And that is why my work has opened up opportunities. It's given people explanations for something that they felt inside but never had words to.
I mean, you both have the professional level, but you also have your personal experience. What helped you break your own cycle?
Well, you know, for me, it's interesting because it has been a process. It's been a journey. It's and that's how I think of it professionally and personally, is it. I had to first figure it out. No one had an explanation of what this codependency was. There wasn't anyone that I believed, and I don't say this narcissistically or egotistically, there just wasn't any successful treatment that out there that solved this codependency thing. The relapse rate was almost in the high 90s. And I had to reconcile the fact that I was a psychotherapist who wanted to be a really good psychotherapist. But every time I got into a relationship or marriage, I was marrying a pathological narcissist. Mm. And that was my secret. I had so much shame about that. And on the second divorce, before my third marriage, I decided I had to figure it out. I just had too much pain. I didn't want to be, you know, there's so many people that say one thing professionally and publicly, but in the background, they don't know, they do the opposite. And I saw myself as a hypocrite, and I couldn't live with that. And that's when I dove into psychotherapy about 15 years ago with the intention of figuring this out. And little by little, puzzle piece by puzzle piece, I started making sense of it. And I built this theoretical base of what would become the human magnet syndrome that explains what codependency is, better explains what narcissism is, and finally explains the forces that are responsible of this habitual problem, this habitual relationship pattern. And for me, as I figured it out in my life, I brought that into my work with my clients. I became better at my work with codependents. And there was a synergy between my own discoveries and healing and my abilities to be a better therapist. And somewhere along the line, I started to write things down. I started to write an essay. I wrote an article. I wrote a seminar. And next thing I know, I wrote a training that became quite, I mean, it was like, I was hired by one of the biggest professional training companies in the United States. And that was going on for 2 years. I think in 2 years, I went to 27 states or 60 cities, and they wanted me to do more. It became just caught on like wildfire because no one had this explanation. And then they asked me to write a book, and I wrote the book, and then I did the YouTube thing, and then all of a sudden it caught on. Hmm. And because people finally had an explanation for something that they not only didn't know about, but they had no control over.
When you talk about the codependent, you said that there's both victimhood, but also responsibility to it.
Yeah, and that's really what makes my work different. And oh boy, there are a lot of people that don't like that.
Yeah,
really pisses them off. And I always start off this explanation by saying there is no excuse for abuse. No matter what I say, there's no excuse for abuse. But then I go on to say, and I know this because it happened to me, and every codependent agrees that I work with that, and that not all codependents, some people are still shut down. Like, because it's an addiction, and the hallmark of an addiction is denial. But the ones who are ready to work on it, they know that if they don't solve this, they're going to be lonely and beaten up for the rest of their life. And so I was able to develop these ideas and concurrently with that, get healthier. And congruently with that, my clients were getting healthier. And I created this material that explained codependency, explained narcissism, explained why the human magnet syndrome works. And after I wrote that book, I started to write about how to treat it, how to solve it, how to cure it. It all came, it's all born from me. I'm very protective. It's funny. I'm very, very, very protective of my intellectual property, not because I'm a businessman and all that stuff, which is part of it. It's because my ideas are my babies. They're me. Everything that I talk about comes from my own learning, my own pain, and my motivation to stop it. Mm. And I'm still working on myself, and I'm still discovering things. So there's a beautiful connection to it all, and I'm so glad that I can make it help other people.
So what I'm wondering is that if there's a double layer of both victimhood and responsibility for the codependent.
I actually never answered your question. I'm so sorry. So what I do differently is I in my book, The Human Magnet Syndrome, I say we make the choices. We keep falling in love with the same people. We are not hijacked or kidnapped into these relationships. It's the dance explanation. The person who is a natural follower needs a dance partner who's a leader, and together it feels comfortable. And my clients, even though it makes them sad and they need to process this, but once they take responsibility, that's when you could change. There's so many videos out there that says the narcissists are bad, bad narcissists, abused, you know, stay away from them. They might make someone feel good, but they don't facilitate change. Mine says, yeah, narcissists are harmful and they're bad, but you keep falling in love with them. So let's figure out what you are doing or what is it about you that brings you to these relationships and solve that so that you can stop this pattern. And like I said in my book, the first chapter explains that this is a transgenerational pattern. It goes from one generation to another. If you want to stop codependency in your life, you also should think about your children and your children's children. And so that is primarily the main reason why assigning responsibility to codependency is critical. You can't get better if the problem is about self-volition choices and you want to blame the other person. That's what the narcissists do. They blame everyone else, but don't take responsibility. My clients not only take responsibility, but understand they also were victims.
I mean, I guess my question is, are narcissists really bad though? I mean, it sounds to me like there's just a bunch of people feeling bad for different reasons. And the codependents have their reasons of feeling bad, and the narcissists have their reasons. And it's just a bunch of people trying to feel connected and find love, but not making it.
Okay, so it's a fair question. In fact, no one's ever asked me that question before. So it's an interesting and fair question. So let's look at it. Let me ask you, are people who are consciously harmful to others for personal gain? So the word bad is tricky. So let's get out the word bad person. Let's use the word harmful person.
Right.
A person who is selfish and exploitative, who chooses to manipulate others, to dominate others, to control others for their own personal good, won't take care of others, but needs others to take care of them. Is this a good person? Well, good and bad is a tricky word, but it's a unhealthy person who is harmful.
I mean, that description fits the codependent as well.
It does not.
I mean, as you describe the codependent as using other people to feel good.
I didn't describe the codependent as using other people to feel good. Codependents are naturally connected to taking care of others for the purpose of feeling connected and loved. Yeah. And so they can be manipulative.
Yeah.
They can be liars.
Yeah.
But their pattern in relationships is to try to get someone to love them, and that they will do almost anything they can to control or manipulate that person to love them. And because they always pick narcissists, because of the human magnet syndrome, they're always in this dance, yeah, and they can never get out of it. It's what I call the codependent delusion, is to try to control someone that's incapable of being controlled. So
I mean, they seem so close to me. They seem so very close to me. And I'm wondering how come you choose to describe one as not doing it consciously and the other one as doing it manipulatively.
Well, yeah, because of psychological and clinical reasons. Mm. When we look at personality disorders, we know that these personality disorders, whether it's narcissistic, borderline, or antisocial personality disorder, the key diagnostic feature is a lack of awareness of the problem. They literally, because of their mental disorder, don't know they have a problem. They are disconnected from being empathetic, from being accountable. I mean, so when we talk about, you know, anxiety or depression or schizophrenia, or even medical disorders, these are diagnoses that actually have been created through research and years of clinical practice. And so you can't diagnose someone with a personality disorder unless they fit. So if we accept those diagnoses, as you know, it's just like if you go in and you sell your doctor you're diabetic, he won't give you insulin unless you are diabetic. If someone says my boyfriend's a narcissist, doesn't mean they don't have a personality disorder. But if they do, they fit a pattern, and the pattern is a lack of awareness for their problem and the core central traits of severe narcissism, selfishness. Right. So the codependent, because of the nature, we go back to my explanation of attachment trauma. If you grew up in an early childhood environment and you were just pounded down during your formative years, it's going to have a profound debilitating impact on your psychological development.
Right.
But if you are the kid who figured out the secret recipe of how to somehow make your narcissistic parent love you and to be that trophy child, that good child, that trauma is exponentially less. So this explains why one actually has no insight into their problem and the other does. But despite the codependent's insight into their problem, that's why codependents can get help. And that is why it's nearly impossible to help pathological narcissists. But even though they are aware of it, they still can't change it. But at least they have the remnants of some psychological health. They have insight over their problem.
All right. So it's a little bit more clear now. And I also would like to hear you say a little bit more about your definition of selfishness. When you describe the narcissist as selfish, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, selfish is selfish. I mean, just, you know, in the dictionary, is someone who focuses on their needs more than others. In healthy relationships, whether it's a business relationship, a family relationship, a romantic relationship, a parent-child relationship, what makes it healthy is two people have positive regard for each other. They respect each other. They care for each other. And there's mutuality. It's not always 50-50, and it doesn't have to be 50-50. But it's the core of mutual respect, love, and caring that creates healthy relationships. And again, I don't think of perfection. Selfishness is the lack of concern or even awareness of needing to have reciprocal, mutual loving relationships. So let's call that selfishness. It's a focus on self at the exclusion of others. So you need much more love, respect, and caring than you want to give. Remember, the definition of codependency is you're in relationships where you give all the love, respect, and caring out. You want to be reciprocal. It's not. You stay in it and you don't change. The narcissist needs all of that, but they won't give it in return. So we call that selfishness.
Yeah, because I mean, sometimes it could be hard to know where self-love stops, selfishness starts.
It's actually, you're right. A lot of people question it. And so that's what my work does is I come up with explanations that are very clear that actually take these ambiguous terms, you know, because self-love, narcissists are filled with self-love. But at the
are they though?
Okay, well, that's the issue. It's we're looking at semantics. So self-love is a focus on themselves.
Yeah.
But self-love is when you, as I describe it, and most people understand it, is someone who loves themselves, respects themselves, and cares for themselves enough where they won't allow others to neglect, abuse, or hurt them. So self-love is just not the act of taking care of yourself. It's wanting to be in healthy relationships. And when they're not, you either instinctually or reflexively navigate yourself away from them. And you put up boundaries. So you can be self-loving and tell someone to hit the road. You can be self-loving and fire someone.
Yeah.
You can be self-loving and divorce someone who's begging for another chance.
Yes.
Self-love is not just about taking care of yourself, but to be in a relationship, a healthy relationship, you have to have mutual self-love. Because someone who loves themselves, who's neither a codependent or a narcissist, there's that mutuality that makes a relationship good. So self-love, looked in that respect, is self-care in a way that promotes a healthy relationship in which you give and take, and it goes both ways.
And I guess this is where I need to take it to another level as well, because I think there's a limitation to describing this phenomenon only with psychological terms. Because when we start to talk about love and self, we also get into the realm of spirituality and existentialism, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's what I've done is, you know, because I am a clinician, I tend to love psychological words, but all of what I do, my books, my seminars, whether they're live or on video, I find the language that speaks to the general public and a therapist that helps them understand this without getting lost in the technical stuff. But I'll tell you something, I'm a very spiritual person. And even the end of my book, the last three paragraphs, I venture into my spiritual beliefs. Mm. But I do this on purpose, is that my expertise, my gift, which I believe is God-given, is to help people solve psychological problems. I am not a talented, spiritually-based practitioner. I stay true to my gift, which I think has spiritual connections, and I don't venture into that because that's not what I believe I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to help people understand the real here and now psychological phenomenon. But I personally embrace and periodically talk about the spiritual side of it all too.
Because what I'm thinking about is that there's something to the notion of focusing too much on the self that is in itself narcissistic. But
it's not, Navid, when the people I'm talking to are SLDs. I'm not talking to the world. I'm not saying, hey, what everyone needs is self-love. My audience is very, very focused. My audience are people with self-love deficit disorder who are codependents. I don't try to be a one-size-fit-all cookie-cutter therapist. All I work with are these SLDs or these codependents. These are the people I speak to. These are the people I'm speaking to now. So, and these people embrace the concepts. Now, the people who don't, I'm going to hope that's good, because that means they don't have a problem in that area, and that they might not find this podcast interesting. But I do know that, you know, through my YouTube success, that there is millions and millions of people. And the fact that my book's in 8 languages is the people that I'm speaking to, they embrace it. And that's all I care about. If you don't have, if you're not an SLD, dismiss me, because that, and I hope it's a good reason, because you're healthy. Mm. And to me, that's a great reason to not want to read my book. But my book is written for one population, and it's a very, very large group of people that is not defined by language or culture or physical boundaries.
So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to just, you know, I'm exploring this while I'm talking. So these are not truths. These are not answers or solutions. And of course, you've been doing this work for so many years. So I'm just having like
a good conversation. I'm glad
conversation on how to. I'm trying to separate self focus from self love, right?
Yeah. I mean,
and also, I mean, when I so let's phrase it like this. How can one raise the level of love or the amount of love in their life, both to themselves and to others, right?
You know, let me say something about what you just said. And I understand. And by the way, I like this conversation, because I think your questions are very similar to what other people think about. And so it's a refreshing interview, because it's coming to me from a different point of view that requires me to explain things. And so I think people are going to appreciate this. So keep the questions coming. But think about this, Navid. The people who are codependent, who are self-love deficient, you think of them like people that have never walked because of a debilitating illness. They want so badly to walk. They want so badly to finally figure out how to love themselves, because they spent a lifetime of being encumbered and buried beneath the rubble of shame. And so in all of their relationships, they have been tied to narcissists because they never knew how to love themselves. So the people that I speak to don't know how to love themselves. So they are empty in this area, and they soak this information up. But if you're healthy, and when I say healthy, I think normal. That means you have as many problems as solutions and strengths, and that's the human condition. There's no such thing as perfection. You don't need to learn about self-love, because you already know it. You believe it. My work will not resonate for them. But for the people that are self-love deficient, who are codependent, it hits a core. And like the person who wants to walk, they will do anything to be what they call normal, to find relationships and where they cannot be abused and hurt. And they want to learn how to love themselves. But if I had someone who was healthy, normal, as I would say, they won't need it. It wouldn't make sense. They go, why do I need that? They know how to love themselves. Mm. So it's the ones that are starved and broken in this area require this perspective. But the other ones, it's not going to make sense. So the difference of someone who is self-loving already, they don't need to become more self-loving, because then that would make them on the narcissistic side.
Right.
The normal person has a nice balance between what I call the distribution of love, respect, and caring, wanting it as much as giving it away.
I guess I'm coming from a place where I meet and hang out with a lot of people. That a lot of my friends, myself included, have been struggling with the whole issue of codependency. And
right.
I mean, I'm in these retreats and workshops, all focused right. on self-love. And
right.
I see this phenomenon of like waking up from the codependency, starting your journey on some kind of recovery, learning the whole self-love part. And I see a lot of people getting stuck and not being able to take that next step. And where they get stuck is... is in some kind of me trap. So the self-love leads into some kind of like exaggerated me focus. And the thing that helped me so this is just like my personal experience. It's just anecdotal. It's one story, but I love to share it. So what helped me was to go from that place of learning how to set boundaries, how to love myself, or in the beginning, like myself or not hate myself.
Right.
So the step that helped me a lot was to let that go and actually loving other people, which I realized I hadn't done before. I used other people to feel valuable or right. to feel like I exist, or right. to actually love other people through that self-love was the step that really, really helped me.
And so you found a way to solve your problems. And you're not an SLD, and that's good.
Oh, I got help. I got help.
No, hear me out.
Yeah.
I want to remind you and your listeners, your viewers, is that my focus is on people who are SLDs or codependents. The world is filled with all sorts of other explanations for other problems. And so your problem, which I understand completely, doesn't fit the diagnosis of self-love deficit disorders. So in your problem, whatever we call it, was you needed to love yourself. You had to find that in yourself and not try to get it from other people. And it sounds like you did some pretty magnificent high-level mental health and emotional healing and growth. But the people that I work with who are considered codependent or SLDs, self-love deficient, their problem is they take care of other people to somehow fill their emptiness. And so they have to figure out how to finally take care of themselves.
Yeah.
Because all they know about in love and safety, which is if you take care of someone else, you won't be rejected. And of course, they fall in love with the narcissist. And so your dilemma came from another point of view. And I want to remind people that it's not all about codependency or narcissism. There's so many other issues and weaknesses and dilemmas and blocks that people have. And my work is just for the folks who are lost in these caretaking sacrificial relationships that they never learn how to take care of themselves because they're always focused on taking care of others.
So how was your transition? I mean, when you realized that you had this problem and when you went from acknowledging it to exercising self-love and setting boundaries, how was that transition for you?
It was hard. My transition is best described by my 10-stage treatment model. And this is not the place to go through each stage, but what I understood was there are many different stages to my path out of this problem. And the stage 5 in this 10-stage model is to finally set boundaries with people who are narcissistic and to expect that the world is going to fight you back. I call it it's my biggest warning I give people is that if you're an SLD or a codependent, that means there's a high probability that most of the people around you are narcissistic because that's how the human magnet syndrome works. And they don't want you to get better. And once you start to get better, they are going to pressure you and manipulate you to stay fixed and constant in your caretaking role. If you break that, I say to them in my warning, you're going to lose 75 to 85% of all of your relationships with people you thought loved you and who you love them. Because I prepare them for the inevitable. Because narcissists will predictably respond to a person's need for self-love, I mean, respect, love, and caring by having a narcissistic injury and fight back. So I say that step 5 is what I call setting boundaries in a hostile environment. I say that because my experience in this process has been tumultuous at times, is that I had to learn that there are consequences of getting healthy. That if you are, such as myself, kept falling in love with narcissists, and if I want to have self-love, then I change the dynamic, that this metaphor, the dance, doesn't work anymore. And all the pressure will be on you to stay codependent. So it has been hard. And then there's, and remember, in my pyramid, there's shame and loneliness and the addiction. I had to go through all of those, all of them, to get out of it, which is how I figured it out. So it's been difficult and tumultuous. I've had really low moments. I've been in psychotherapy. You know, I dealt with other addictions in order to take away the pain. The recovery from self-love deficit disorder, codependency, is one of the hardest things that a person's going to do. Because not only do you have to change what's broken inside of you that you don't know how to change because it's trauma, and you need a trauma therapist, but once you get strong enough to change relationships, it's like the world is going to work against you. And you have to be strong enough and self-loving enough to stay on the path while, what's the saying? The chaff is separated from the wheat. And you start to reinvent yourself and you move from self-love deficit disorder and you transition to self-love abundance, which is why I like my labels, because I say self-love deficit disorder is a problem, but once you solve it, you no longer have that diagnosis. You're self-love abundant. I don't like the idea that people have to carry this negative term, whether it's self-love deficit disorder or codependency. I like the idea if you solve a problem, then you don't have the problem anymore.
I mean, it when you look at it, it's easy to see the narcissist as a perpetrator and the codependent as a victim, right?
But that's not how I look at it. I look at them as that they're working together. One causes more harm than the other, but the codependent is an active participant in it. Mm-hmm. I don't subscribe to that victim model. Because the codependent, you know, there's a lot of therapists out there that will see the codependents and say, yeah, poor you, bad narcissist. That doesn't solve the reason why they keep falling in love with the narcissist. Yeah. They have to figure out that they keep falling in love with them because they choose that. So they're responsible because of the relationship, just not the abuse.
So my second question was about, you know, the sense of dynamics in a relationship. I mean, the difference between being hostage in a codependent marriage and being in a dynamic, passionate relationship where you have these polarities that dance, but in a constructive and like positive way.
So you actually bring up, I think, three questions. One is there is no constructive relationship that involves a codependent and narcissist, because a codependent narcissist relationship, it's all about the narcissist needing and taking all of the love, respect, and caring at the exclusion of the codependent. So there's no such thing of that being healthy, in no way categorically. If this is a balanced relationship where someone is a caretaker and someone is more self-centered and there's give and take, then you got a healthy relationship. And I talk about that in my book. It's not just this dichotomous, polarized vision of it. You can have someone who's on the self-centered side and someone on the giving side, but yet they take care of themselves. Right. That could be healthy. Yeah. There's just no way that you can have a healthy relationship when it's all about someone else. And because that other person is going to be lonely and shame-based and not ever know that they deserve to be treated better.
Mm. Right. And also, I'm curious if you can see in the groups of narcissists and codependents, is there anything indicating that there might be like more men in one group and more?
Absolutely. And I actually think this is cultural. And culture is, there's so many other contaminants, as I would call, that infect this attachment trauma process. And so just to be clear, codependency is caused because you have a narcissistic parent who only can love you for what you do to them and how it makes you feel good, and you mold yourself to that person, and that's the birth of this problem. But what happens if you come from a country that is a misogynistic country, that, you know, that everything is about the man, that the culture is, you know, the man is on top.
Right.
And there are many cultures, many ethnic groups and some religions that are very much geared of male dominance and female passivity. Well, that in itself does not cause codependency, but it impacts it. So if you come from a culture like that and you have a narcissistic parent, it makes it worse. I've had so many clients that from the Middle East and Asia, and I don't want to name countries, but there are some countries and some cultures that that dismiss, marginalize women. They pretend that they're invisible. And that's just the culture. And so if you're from that culture and you're raised in by a narcissist, then you're getting it. There's no hope. And it's very sad because, you know, I've worked with people, one country, Sudan, a woman from Sudan, and she had no hope because there was no social services. There was no mental health. There was no one that provided an opportunity to explain why she as a woman had to give up so much of her freedom. Yeah. And that wasn't about mental health. That was about culture. That was about, you know, views on mental health services. So that's why people from all over the world are responding to my YouTube videos, because they can get this information from places that it's just not available in their country.
Hmm.
Yeah, I actually kind of got off, and I don't know if I answered your question, but there are many other factors that kind of feed into this.
Is the feminine masculine part of it. Like, is there any part of the male psychology or biology that creates the exaggeration that becomes narcissism?
Okay, so thank you for keeping me on track. You're a good interviewer. I can speak on the culture from which I come from. Yeah. It's evolved quite a lot since, you know, the 40s and the 50s, but it for the longest time it was male oriented, and because of that, you know, that impacted the development of people's gender roles that they would bring into relationships. That in itself is not about narcissism and codependency. That's cultural. So if you're from the United States in the 1950s, the man worked and you were the mom and you stayed home and cared for your children, you were the caregiver. And he was the provider, and he wasn't necessarily very emotional because that was the model for men back then. But because of that, there is a higher proportion of codependents that are female than male, because how do we know? Okay, let me say it this way. When it comes to treating, I believe that they're equally represented because of the nature of how it's caused. And I believe that it's almost 50-50. But as far as people seeking treatment, the ones that seek treatment are the ones that are identified. It's probably around 65, 70 women and 30 men, because men from my culture aren't as emotional, don't have the background to talk about their feelings, to be vulnerable with their emotions. Women, because of culture, yeah, in this country at least, are more open to that. And if you're more open to talking about your feelings, seeking therapy is more consistent and safer. So men, and I believe it might be universal, believe they have to hold that stuff inside and take care of it themselves. So these are the, so they're less likely to seek psychotherapy for their relationship problems.
Oh yeah.
But my experience is they're equally represented because it goes back to the cause of codependency. It's the child that is the gifted child, the trophy child. Mm. But the ones that we see, the ones that are seeking help, are mostly women. So all of my demographics, whether it's on YouTube, you know, YouTube, it's 65-35, men versus women. On Instagram, it's 85-15. On my people are mostly women, because men just, you know, some of us are raised just not to like think that way, or, you know, just tough it out. And I like to think it's universal.
Yeah. Oh, I see that a lot among my male friends. And I do a lot of men's work. We do these retreats and workshops and weekends for men.
Right.
Share where they're at and share their emotions. And one of the first things that that appeared to me was that this is very unusual for a lot of men to even be in a circle and to share and to be vulnerable, or to cry, or to put words to your emotions. That's basically the first step.
Yeah, I actually was in a men's group for 11 years, very similar to the Mankind Project. That is it was called Victories of the Heart, which is more of a Chicago, Illinois based. But it was that 11-year experience that had profound impact on my healing. Mm. It was part of my journey, and it sounds like it was also impactful on yours too.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's one thing. I've been going to psychotherapy for for at least 10, 15 years on and off.
Right.
But doing that kind of, I would call it like physical therapy and group right. therapy is something else. And especially to do it with other men, like in that kind of community has been really valuable.
Oh my God. What's healing? I mean, I was in there for 11 years and I was so into this organization. I was part of the staff. Yeah. The idea for a man to be around other men where you can talk about your feelings and hug, it was kind of funny. Whenever we had get togethers that would include our partners or spouses, the joke was, this is where men hug each other and women shake hands. and for a man to learn about that, it really was instrumental in everything that helped me figure it out, my self-love development.
Yeah.
I had to go through that 11 years and my own therapy and my own will. So I'm grateful that you brought that up, because there men are so isolated. A friend of mine who is a coach, Rick Belden, he actually wrote the foreword to my book. He's out of Austin, Texas. That's one of his specialties, is, you know, working with men to find their masculinity and also their sensitivity and sense of emotional connection with themselves.
Yeah.
No, we don't learn that growing up.
Oh, we don't. And also, I mean, just looking at other men and seeing other men as brothers instead of competitors, everything being a competition. I love competitions. I love games because it's fun.
And we're men.
I want to win, of course. Yeah. And I want to learn. I want to battle it out with other men and women. I mean, but not seeing everything, not seeing all my life as a competition, or not seeing, I mean, especially not seeing relationships as a competition of who gets what or who gets more or less attention, or that's been really important to me. And I think that also helped me to get a perspective on a lot of behaviors, my own and my male friends as well, I wouldn't want to diagnose it as narcissistic, but it was, you know, using relationships and using work or using social media to get attention.
Right.
And that got me wondering. I'm not seeking, you know, diagnosis for like a narcissistic diagnosis for society. But I was wondering if you can see narcissistic tendencies in social media and society today.
You know, I'm often asked about, you know, is this new generation, the millennials, you know, this new wave of narcissists? Mm. And I say no. And, you know, I'm kind of a hip old guy. I'm going to be like 59 in March. And I kind of look at every generation finding their way and developing their own identity. And this generation is doing what the generation before them did. And they just have the internet. And they have, and yeah, there's, you know, there's a lot of people that are lonely and disconnected and find these social networks, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, to say, hey, look at me. And they get obsessed with it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's healthy. And I think that's a different problem. It's not about these people that are posting pictures of, you know, they're like, in, you know, half dressed and, you know, and look at me smiling every time. I think of them as like lonely people who don't have any connections. They could either be narcissists or codependents.
Right.
So I think the problem with, today's generation and these social networking is it isolates people more. And again, remember to remind you, not everything is about codependent and narcissism. So you can be an isolated narcissist and you can be like, you know, an author narcissist, an actor narcissist, a sports figure. So I think we have a generation that is that knows less about social connection, social skills, relationships, but it's about isolation. And then there are people who are narcissists who are posting stuff about themselves all the time. And then there are people who are codependents who are posting stuff about themselves all the time, but they do it for different reasons. And they both have this audience that they think. So I think it's more about how disconnected this new generation is. But I see a lot of really good things in this new generation. And they're going to be just like my generation that, you know, that everyone said was going to not amount to anything. They're going to grow up and find out that they need jobs and they're going to adapt. And I think the best of these kids are going to be, you know, the contributors of the world. I have a much more positive and accepting opinion on these, what seems to be self-obsessed millennials. And they are different. Just like the Generation X were different. And this and the baby boomers, they all have their uniqueness based upon the generation that preceded them. So I'm optimistic and positive. And just, you know, my son, Ben, who's 25, oh my God, that's all he did was he was on his Xbox. And one day I had this major moment of insight. His best friend who lived across the street came over to sleep over, because they do that when they're that age, and they just bought this new Xbox game, and they were excited. And then Brian went home, and I go, Ben, why is Brian going home? He goes, well, because it's more exciting to play him when he's on his side of the versus him watching me,
right?
And that's when I understood, well, this is just a new way that these kids are socializing.
Yeah.
That you still can have these friendships. So I say that was his generation that, you know, and he quit playing Xbox habitually 5 years ago. So I think that a lot of these kids who, you know, are kind of obsessed with some of these social networking are going to grow up just like we did and find some level of normality. That's my optimistic view. I don't see it as a problem with narcissism. The problem with narcissism is because our parents are harmful to us, right? Not because of the social networking.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a spectrum, right? And
oh, yeah, sure.
It's like the extreme versions on the different sides of the spectrum. But what I hear when people, myself included, when we post stuff or when we seek attention, it's like there's always this underlying question of, am I okay? Am I okay? Am I okay? And that's very human. That's very...
I mean, I'm from the 70s. I would have done it.
Yeah.
Now, I do think that it was much better for kids back then to like go out and play and actually play. But I also know that I was a kid who was really, really shy and had all sorts of social and emotional problems. And if I had the internet, I might have found a way to be connected and have friends.
Right.
And so, and I didn't. So I was very lonely and had all these problems. So, you know, it goes both ways. But I think in an excess, social media is not good for the kids. And but I also have an optimistic view. If you come from a family where you're loved and respected and cared for, you come from normal parents who are good and as many good and bad things, who just try their best, you know, you grow out of it. You go into college, you go into grad school, and you know, it's really about your early childhood experiences that are to worry about. You know, the whole Facebook thing or the whole Instagram thing, those are connections to the more core part of your personality. Mm. That's my thoughts.
Yeah. So let's work on the core, right?
Well, I think so. Cause you know, if you got a 16-year-old who's like, you know, obsessed with, you know, all these social networking things, and they come from a solid family where they've got a dad and a mom and they do their good and they feel loved and cared for. And the marriage is a good marriage. They're going to put it aside as they grow up, and they're going to choose real relationships. And that's just a part of, you know, when I was a kid, I listened to FM radio all the time and played, you know, albums, you know, that's what we did. And we would stand and, you know, and I think, and so that's, you grow out of it. If you have a healthy base, well, I listen to music now, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know a little bit more about your next project. You were telling me you were writing your next book. So give us a little bit more insight about that.
Well, the human magnet syndrome, the codependent narcissist trap, which is available at my selfloverecovery.com website and Amazon, that explains the problem. And it explains it in a way that helps SLDs or codependents to identify their part in it. And if you can't solve a problem, if you don't know what it is, I think of, like, you know, back, you know, for 1,000 years, you know, they had this procedure called bloodletting. Mm. They thought if, you know, you put, you know, you take people's blood out, I think George Washington died prematurely because of that, that was a cure. Well, they didn't know where these problems came from. So without knowing these illnesses, they were using these treatments that didn't work. So the first part of my work is describing the problem in a way that makes sense. And that's the human magnet syndrome. The next part is explaining the solution, which is, I call the codependency cure. And I talk about my self-love recovery treatment program. And so that's what my next book is about. And it's going to take about a year to write. So I tell, I have all that information on these, I give seminars, live presentations, and I record them. And so there are 15 seminars on my selfloverecovery.com site and on what is going to be the codependency cure book. So until it's written, that information is out there. And I also, I don't speak much. I mean, don't speak much. I don't give trainings that often anymore, but I'm giving one of my first live trainings in a while at the Kripalu Institute out in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, at the end of February. And if anyone's interested in that, just go to selfloverecovery.com. I also created weekend retreat or intensive weekends, which actually have some connection to the men's group that I used to belong to, although it's quite different. And so that's one of my ongoing passions, is providing these 3-day intensive life-changing retreats. So that, you know, that combined, creating the videos, writing my book, providing these workshops and the weekend retreat, that's kind of my focus right now.
So if you could suggest, I mean, not only for codependents, but for people in general wanting to practice more self-love, do you have like three advice to give, or three tips to do it in a practical way?
Yeah, the first one is to be as honest as you possibly can about your level of happiness. The problem with SLDs or codependents, they often are in relationships in which the narcissist gaslights them. that not only are they responsible, which you've heard me say, of their problem, but sometimes I would say 50% of the codependent narcissist relationship, the narcissist actually is purposefully, knowingly, and systematically entrapping the codependent. So the first piece of advice I'd give is to like allow yourself to be honest with your life. Because, you know, one person once joked that denial is an acronym, and that it stands for don't even know I am lying, except no is spelled wrong. But as much of it as is a joke, it's a very important point that denial, we don't even know it, is to wake up and look in the mirror and to say, I'm lonely. Mm. People don't love me. So that is the most important stage, which is actually the stage one of my 10-stage treatment model, is to like admit to yourself what has happened to you in your life.
Yeah.
The second piece of advice is to know that you're not alone. Because if you finally connect to your shame and loneliness and think you're alone, there's no hope for it, which is why so many people flock to the internet and to YouTube or read books such as mine. And then the third thing I'd suggest people as a stage is to believe that you're worth it to get better. Because it doesn't matter how smart an author is or how good of a therapist is. If you don't believe you're worth getting better, you'll never get to that. You'll never make that first step out of your shame-based, isolated, codependent self into your therapist or office.
So share honestly, connect with others, and believe that you're worth it.
Yeah, I would say that. I would say the first one is to be open to understanding your pain and suffering. Mm. I think those steps are the basis for everything that follows.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Very clear. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, please.
I was going to thank you for this interview. It's been very enlightening, and I enjoyed your questions. And I believe that you are doing some really great work out there, and I support you completely.
Thank you so much. Thank you for taking time. I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope we can talk more in the future.
I'd like to.
And I really enjoy your work. I'm looking forward to the new book as well. When do you think it's out?
I got to write it.
You got to write it first.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to say a year and 6 months.
Good. I'm going to hold you to that.
but I'm doing a lot of other stuff that is making my information available.
I think that the world will benefit from that book as well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
So in the end of every episode, we ask our guests to recommend someone they like us to connect with and to have as a guest on the podcast. So who would you like to hear on that?
I'm a really big fan of Lisa Romano. She is perhaps, you know, there's a lot of people on YouTube that talk about codependency and narcissism, and a lot of them are opportunists who don't really know what they're talking about, but they're very charismatic, and people are vulnerable to that. She is the opposite. She's the real thing. She is, she works with codependents, and she does really good work in helping them heal, and she is very well known, respected, and I think is an icon in the field.
Lisa Romano.
Yeah, you'll find her on YouTube. She's quite the force.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that.
I have a couple of videos of her and I on YouTube.
So. Oh, nice. Oh, well. So, brother Ross, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you, brother. Look. And best to you, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.